GTD News. I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg up next.
Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTDHD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm delighted to welcome into our studios, first of all, a good friend of the station. I almost said an old friend. I won't say it that way, but Dr. Art Sear, Professor
you
Art
say
Sear,
it that way.
Director of the Clausen Center at Carthage College. And Professor Sear is here with a very special guest that the Clausen Center and Carthage College is hosting, a Carthage alum by the name of Josiah Lamb, who is a former forensic accountant for the FBI, who now is part of a very interesting organization called Waypoint. And this is a team of former FBI and IRS agents who do essentially investigative accounting for all kinds of different firms and organizations and so on. And they look at the numbers in a way that the rest of us can only sort of wonder about. And we have the next few minutes to speak with him about the work that he does. Josiah Lamb is visiting Carthage right now as its current executive in residence. So first of all, we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Good morning. Thank you.
Good to have you here. Professor Sear, could you just say a word about this executive in residence program that's been going on at Carthage for quite some time now?
Yeah, it's now well established. Stephen Chapman, a senior executive at Cummins Corporation, the great successful American manufacturing firm, I emphasize, that still makes things domestically as well as overseas. He currently has principal international involvement in Asia, notably China. He and his wife are Carthage parents, and he was a Carthage trustee for a time when his schedule was a little somewhat easier, and their daughter was at Carthage. He and his wife, Mr. and Mrs. Chapman, endowed the Executive in Residence program to bring people who provide positive personal as well as impressive professional examples to the campus to interact with our students in particular, of course, but also staff and faculty. And it's unfolded very successfully, like most senior executives who are durable. Mr. Chapman provided us with a real insight. And it's particularly valuable for our students, I've learned over time, to have relatively recent Carthage graduates. And Josiah is a 2001 graduate and interacts with his students very, very skillfully, as well as with the rest of us.
Very good. And I should mention, too, that although the executive-in-residence title might suggest a certain sort of executive to someone who hears that term, in fact, you've really invited a wide array of people from a wide array of different businesses and organizations and agencies. I mean, you've really not tried to just sort of pigeonhole a narrow view of what that kind of work involves.
Well, that's right. Actually, when this program was established, our previous president, Greg Campbell, and the Board of Trustees, several of them were very explicit in saying they didn't think it should be limited to business. Since our students very heavily go into the business world nowadays, which is just great as far as I'm concerned, I think since professors should be contrarians, I have given some emphasis to the nonprofit, government, and service fields. And Josiah, of course, is someone who in different ways represents all three, but currently the business world. We had Christina Bruff, class of 2004, this past spring with a great interview on your fine program, and she's made her way through the Peace Corps, turned down several corporate jobs. She was really a star graduate and turned down corporate jobs, went into the Peace Corps, got a master's degree in public policy from Princeton, and has made her way very effectively in government service, currently at the Bureau of African Affairs at the State Department.
That was a fun interview. And I know this one will be as well. I'm really excited about this. Again, Josiah Lamb joining us. Josiah, one of the first things I have to say is this is really uncharted territory for me of everything I can think of in terms of various academic disciplines. I feel like the one I know the least about is accounting, as someone who doesn't even balance his own checkbook. So I'm going to trust that you'll guide me through some of the more complicated aspects of the important and I'm sure fascinating work that you do. Say a quick word about where you come from, and I hope in doing so you'll also mention the size of your graduating high school class.
Oh, yes. I come from small towns in Minnesota and Wisconsin. My father was a pastor, and so we moved around to small communities. And I graduated from a small town in central Wisconsin called Granton, and I had 27 kids in my graduating class.
So that was one of those schools
right
where everybody did everything, I'm assuming.
That's
so
exactly right.
Play in the band, and you're yep. on the line on the football team, and yep. who knows what else. Yeah.
Yes, definitely.
You went to Carthage as an accounting major. Did anything in particular fuel your interest in accounting? I mean, when did numbers become important to you?
In my first accounting class, I had Professor Dawson, who near the end of the course said, "Why don't you major in accounting? You're pretty good at this." And I said, "Okay." Mm. And that was it.
So yeah. you didn't come to Carthage with that in mind?
I did not come to Carthage with that in mind. I came as a business administration major.
Mm-hmm. Had you always been good in math?
Yeah. Yep. I was pretty good in math.
I think accounting is not only accounting itself do I not understand particularly well, but I really have no sense of the academic discipline of accounting. I think most of us from the outside looking in just don't understand what there is to learn about accounting that would occupy, for instance, a whole major at the collegiate level. What kinds of things does one study in this field?
The field is very broad. You can do a lot of things in accounting. There are accountants everywhere doing wonderful work in in-house corporate companies. Everybody needs accountants. Everybody needs tax work done. And so you study auditing, tax, the fundamentals of how to perform accounting. And I forgot there's also the public accounting side of the world, which is very large and much needed in auditing and other assurance services.
Mm-hmm. As you graduated from Carthage, did you have a strong sense of what you wanted to do?
Yeah, when I graduated, I wanted to go into public accounting, which I did. I started at Ernst & Young up in Milwaukee, took the CPA exam, and was doing public accounting for about 5 years.
And can you just explain what that term even means? What does a public accountant do? And and especially for whom do you do the work?
Right. Public accounting is divided into a couple of different areas. I focused on audit. So we went to companies and audited their books and records and issued an opinion that about the fairness or the accuracy of their accounting records.
So a firm would hire you to do this?
Yes.
And so you would come?
Companies, I work, most large companies have auditors, and so they would hire the audit firm that I worked for, and we'd go in and do audits.
Mm-hmm. And then at some point, you make the jump to become a forensic accountant for the FBI. And, of course, when we see that in your biography, that leaps right off the page.
Right.
Explain how that came about.
The transition occurred shortly after I started to go to law school part-time. I was working full-time in public accounting, and part-time law school and public accounting is not a good mix. There's not enough time in the day to do both. So I was looking for jobs, and I applied to the FBI. I didn't hear anything for about 4 months, and then they called out of the blue and had me come down for a polygraph and background, and they started my background, and I started working there about in October, so 8 months later after that.
Of what year?
2006.
Hmm. So you were a forensic accountant for the FBI. Explain what that term means.
Forensic accountants, the forensic accounting field is really investigative accounting for legal proceedings. So tracing money, figuring out how someone used money to determine whether a crime was committed or not, and if there was, how he used the money, he or she used the money, and trace any asset purchases for potential forfeiture by the government.
Hmm. So what would a given case sort of look like or feel like that you would be investigating as a forensic accountant?
Typically, it's some sort of an embezzlement from a company. We have a lot of those lately. A company will find some anomaly in their books and records and then call us to investigate it further and figure out if there was a theft and quantify that theft and refer that to law enforcement.
Hmm. So typically, how is that work done? And I mean, what exactly are you doing? I mean, obviously, the company itself must be aware that something doesn't line up here.
Yep.
So they're already aware, in a sense, that the ledger isn't balanced.
Right.
What would somebody like you do as a forensic accountant to get behind that?
So we look at their accounting records and pull bank statements. Typically, the easiest way is to follow the money. The money has to leave the business somehow, and it has to flow through a bank statement typically. And so we look at bank statements, the checks, wire details, and figure out where the money went.
How do you sort of identify that this money here went there? I mean, what is sort of attached to the money itself that allows it to be traced?
Yeah, the typically we'll know more about what the embezzler did and how they did it. We'll talk to the company, and they'll identify whether there's a suspicious vendor that they used, whether there's checks that go to their personal account. A lot of embezzlements are not very complex. We've had several recently. One in particular, the embezzler wrote checks to an entity that they shouldn't be writing checks to. It was a known entity to the company, but the checks were very large. They were, you know, $200,000, $300,000, $400,000 at a time, and this was a company that a vendor that the company wasn't really using. So that made them very suspicious. We got some additional bank statements and figured out that the woman was transferring money into this other entity and then transferring it right to her personal accounts.
Because she had access to that?
Because she had access to that entity. And
so, in other words, that was a way to get the money out of the company without it looking strange.
Yes.
And then once that money was out of the company, then into this account that she had access to, then she could transfer it further to her own account. And
correct.
She's home free.
Right.
Except for people like you who are watching for that.
Right. And then in the accounting record, she would classify that payment as some other payment to some other big vendor that they would spend a lot of money with. Hmm. So it would look like a normal $200,000 payment to somebody else.
Hmm. So when someone is embezzling, how is it that they do that without fear of being caught? I mean, are they unaware of the access that, for instance, the company has, or the scrutiny that every transaction potentially is under, or does a lot of embezzlement not get detected at all? I mean, as you lay out the work you do, it seems really crystal clear, and it seems impossible for somebody to get away with this, and yet people continue to do this and in escalating numbers.
Yeah, and what embezzlers typically do is they identify a weakness in some sort of internal control that they can have access to writing checks, approving checks, and making a journal entry in the accounting system to be able to hide it. And so they have control over all three of those processes, and so then they can, you know, take money at their leisure and hope that nobody catches them. And a lot of victims are either large businesses with, like I said, a gap in internal controls, or smaller businesses that have owners who implicitly trust their employees.
Hmm. So when you are brought aboard, typically does the company already know that embezzlement is going on and even have a rough idea of who might be responsible? Or in some cases, are you helping a company right from square one, where they at the moment don't really even have an idea of why this anomaly in their books occurs?
Yeah, typically the embezzler is known. The company has either terminated the person or have identified some of their suspicious activity. There are a few instances where the company doesn't know who took the money or they know that one person's involved, and they want to know if other people are involved, if there's some sort of collusion among the staff, or whether it's just one bad actor.
Hmm. And how is it that you are able to do that kind of investigative work more than, for instance, the company itself? I mean, do you have access to things that they do not have, or is it just a matter of you have the time to do it, and it would take too much time for the company themselves to try to track down the specifics?
Typically, it's a resource issue. The companies have very busy accounting staffs, and we can prepare all of the evidence in a way that we know law enforcement will want to see it, and then we can make a referral fairly quickly and easily to them so that they can hit the ground running to do the parts of the investigation we don't have access to as normal citizens and non-law enforcement
folks. And once you make some kind of determination of, yes, this is where the money went, this person was responsible for it, do you share that information then back to the company, or are you sharing that information directly with law enforcement? I guess it makes a difference if at the time you're working for the FBI,
right,
in which case you are part of law enforcement.
Right, right. And I'm talking from my current position at Waypoint. We would typically meet with the client, get their approval to refer it to law enforcement, and then have a meeting with the attorney involved, us, and law enforcement. We've got some direct connections to get access to law enforcement.
I know that one of the cases that gained you some notoriety and won for you actually an award in your field was the case of U.S. versus Thomas J. Petters.
Yes.
Can you explain what this case was about?
This is a very large Ponzi scheme. Mr. Petters was on the face a very successful businessman. He purchased Polaroid and Sun Country Airlines and a couple other businesses. But it turns out the only way he was able to do that was by running a Ponzi scheme and stealing money from investors.
And I know a lot of our listeners are probably well acquainted with that term, but for those who don't remember exactly what a Ponzi scheme is, that's what got Mr. Madoff in such trouble, too.
Correct.
But explain how a Ponzi scheme typically works.
So a Ponzi scheme usually has the promise of some sort of investment for great returns. In this case, Mr. Petters was purported to be selling inventory to big box retailers on the gray market. And so he would say he's got, 1,000 TVs. He's trying to get from an undisclosed company to sell to Costco, for example, or Sam's Club. And he would take investors' money In Ponzi schemes, you take new investor money to pay old investors the returns you promised, because there's no underlying goods in the scheme.
It's all fake.
It's all fake. Yeah, no, there's thousands of fake purchase orders and fake documents. And
so in this case, there's no TVs.
There's no TVs.
There's no 1,000 TVs, actually.
No,
so you're just pretending there are.
Right, right. And very convincingly, and getting large investments. The net loss in the Petters case on a cash basis is a little over $2 billion. Hmm. In comparison, the Madoff case, the net cash loss is about $16 billion. Hmm. Still very large amounts.
So what was the work that you did on that case? I mean, what were you charged with doing?
So at the beginning, I was with the FBI at the time, and I was... my role was to trace the money, figure out what happened financially in the bank accounts. And so I charted out the bank accounts, figured out what happened in the main Ponzi scheme account, and then how Tom distributed money outside of the Ponzi scheme, because he took about $400 million for himself and paid others big bonuses and donated large amounts to charities. And so my job was to follow the money.
Hmm. So when you came aboard this case, it was already clear that Mr. Petters was doing something wrong?
Yes, yes. There was a whistleblower who came in, the woman who was the operations person behind the Ponzi scheme. She brought a list of the amounts owed to investors at the time. This was September 2008, and I was out of the office on leave for about a month with my newly born son, and so I had some phone communications while I was out, and then when I came back, I stepped into to do the financial analysis.
So you had to specifically trace where all this money went.
Right.
And what was the point of that? I mean, what ultimately is the benefit of knowing those kind of specifics?
We have to know where, you know, if it's a Ponzi scheme, you got to figure out whose money went where and figure out at the end of the day who the net winners and the net losers are, so you can identify the victims in the case. And you can prove it in as it turned out, in trial, the dynamics of the entity and how it really was a Ponzi scheme and there was no underlying goods.
Mm-hmm.
The woman you mentioned,
yeah,
you indicated in classes that she got a substantially reduced sentence, which is instructive concerning how the justice system works in terms
yes.
of investigation and
yeah, she Tom
and conviction.
Tom was convicted after a trial. He got a 50-year sentence. Hmm. And is spending his time now in Leavenworth, Kansas. The whistleblower cooperator who did an extraordinary job producing amazing recordings and,
yeah.
and additional evidence to really make this case move at lightning speed, she got a year and a day.
Wow.
And yeah. she must have felt it. Some risk given the nature of these personalities she was working with.
Oh, yes.
The way you described
yep.
this guy.
Yes. Yep.
It took a lot of guts.
It took a lot of guts to come in.
Hmm. Now, the work that you were doing, is there, I think a lot of us, again, from the outside looking in, assume that there's great clarity and that, I mean, numbers don't lie and numbers either add up or they don't add up. And so I think we assume that there's kind of a clarity to it in terms of, for instance, following where the money goes. In fact, is it more complicated than that? And are you having to, in a sense, maybe interpret numbers or draw deductions from numbers? I mean,
yeah.
what are we talking about
yeah,
here?
It's not always that easy. Oftentimes, you know, you can see somebody purchase a car or purchase a house and large transactions. But sometimes they transfer money to an entity that you don't know anything about. And when you're not law enforcement, you don't have subpoena power to just go subpoena that entity's bank records to figure out what that entity is and how that money was being used. So yeah, there is a little magic to it.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Josiah Lamb, who is the current executive in residence at Carthage College, a former forensic accountant for the FBI. He is now part of a team of former FBI and IRS agents called Waypoint. And so they continue to do this kind of investigative accounting work for a number of different organizations and agencies. I know from reading your biography that one of the areas in which you've done considerable work is healthcare fraud. That was a little bit of a surprise to me. What are some instances of healthcare fraud that you have investigated as a forensic accountant?
There are, as you can imagine, that this healthcare system is very large, very complicated, and provide ample opportunities for individuals to commit healthcare fraud. There, we have a matter that, or I've worked on a matter where a doctor's group is improperly billing insurance companies for services either not rendered or overstating the cost of the services to overbill the insurance companies and receive a reimbursement for unnecessary and improper expenses.
How is that typically brought to your attention? I mean, what kind of an entity would be sort of waving a red flag about that?
Insurers typically will be waving that red flag. Sometimes doctors' groups come in and have questions about billing practices as well.
I would think that it's especially a risk if a doctor has a private practice that stands alone versus being part of a team or on the staff of a hospital or something. I don't know under what kind of scrutiny somebody like that even operates.
Oh yeah, yeah. There's all sorts of scrutiny in the system, and Medicare is getting better at identifying and trying to root out fraud. They've got a pretty big team for the government doing that type of work.
What about mortgage fraud, which is another field in which you do a
yes.
lot of work?
What
sort of mortgage fraud are we talking about?
So when I was with the government, there's all sorts of ways people commit mortgage fraud. And during the late 2000s, mortgage fraud was a significant problem in the country, and we saw it in the housing market collapse and the mortgage market collapse. People would get no income loans and be grossly unqualified to ever make a mortgage payment, but they'd be able to obtain a mortgage through a crooked broker and take possession of a house, and you know the seller would overvalue the house. One example is a seller would overvalue a house and get an unqualified buyer and be able to get that buyer a mortgage and steal that money. There's all sorts of creative ways that mortgage brokers were able to commit healthcare fraud. The regulations have and the tightening of lending really assisted with clamping down on that mortgage fraud, but there's still some in the system.
Hmm. You, of course, have begun doing this work at a point in time when banking and accounting is done electronically almost entirely, versus what this work would have been 30 or 40 years ago. Even though you don't have personal connection to those old practices, I'm sure you've to some extent learned about that and have some sense of how dramatically things have changed. First of all, do you think this is the kind of environment in which wrongdoing is more likely to occur because there is this ease of electronic transaction that not only makes that also enables misdeeds to occur just that easily, and does it sometimes give the perpetrators a sense of insulation and anonymity that again might maybe encourage this kind of wrongdoing?
Yeah, I think technology allows for more creative ways to steal money. There's more opportunity to do so with the technological advances on mobile banking and being able to transfer money in all sorts of different ways, and it's also provided criminals ways to hide money transactions or attempt to hide money transactions in more creative ways than they did in the past.
And I'm sure one of those ways is that money can be more easily taken and deposited in other countries. What kind of a conundrum does that present to you and your fellow investigators if somebody is taking money, for instance, they have embezzled and put it in a
right.
bank someplace
yeah.
else?
Yeah.
And what kind of access do you have as an investigator to those kind of financial institutions?
Yeah, on the private side, we have very little access. The government side has some level of access, but it's not as simple as sending a subpoena to a bank overseas. We had one instance where a gentleman put $15 million in an asset protection trust, and the trust was in one of the islands, and I don't remember exactly which island it was on, but the actual cash was sitting in a bank in Switzerland. And so getting access to those records in Switzerland were nearly impossible, and the trust records were nearly impossible. But the criminal who put the money over there assisted in the recovery of that. Otherwise, it probably would have been, I don't want to say impossible, but nearly very challenging to be able to get that. And that was when I was with the government.
Wow. So, let alone what you're doing now.
Yeah. Let alone in private practice, where we have no real authority to go to foreign governments and foreign banks to request records.
So you have to go to law enforcement in order to try to secure that.
Yep. And they have to do that on their own.
Right. Let's talk for a moment about that switch which you decided to make from being a former forensic accountant with the FBI to in a sense going into private practice with this group called Waypoint. Did anything in particular inspire you to make that change?
Yeah, I had to stop in the middle there. I practiced law for 3 years prior to joining Waypoint, and so the big driver for me leaving the FBI was going into practice law after going to law school. I wanted to get some experience. I joined a great boutique white collar criminal defense firm, and at that firm was the trustee. The bankruptcy trustee and receiver for the Tom Petters case. So I was able to bring some institutional knowledge to that matter for several years and practice law at the same time.
Hmm. So the work that you do with Waypoint sounds, if I'm interpreting the description correctly, a little more far-reaching in terms of the kind of services that you offer to a really wide array of businesses and agencies.
Certainly.
What kind of help are you able to give?
Certainly. So we do these white-collar criminal investigations. We also do internal investigations. We help with healthcare compliance programs. We have investigators who do interviews for all sorts of different types of cases. We've been involved with helping large companies do background investigations of executives and help them with sensitive investigations they have for various matters.
Hmm. You also deal directly related with government regulation.
Yeah, we do some.
For corporations, but other organizations, and federal regulation, of course, has understandably become a major issue in the current campaign.
Yeah,
that was something I wanted to ask you about. What sorts of regulations are we typically talking about that might be of concern to a company in terms of being in proper compliance?
For us, it's typically healthcare regulations, which are, as you've seen, ever-changing and very complex.
So give an example, a real-life example of a company.
So we've helped an insurer develop compliance program, a piece of their compliance program, and we have some experts on our staff that have that experience and knowledge to be able to do that.
I'm still not sure I understand what would be a typical array of healthcare regulations.
So there's all sorts of rules that you have to follow in terms of payment processing, how you comply with your duties and obligations as insurers or other healthcare companies. To make sure you don't violate the rules.
So right now we're talking about a healthcare provider or an insurance provider.
Yep.
And so there are regulations about the timeliness of payments that kind of thing.
Yep.
So when you and your team are brought in, typically is a company in trouble or are they just wanting information or typically what are the circumstances under which you come into a company?
For regulatory issues, typically they're not in trouble. Typically they're just trying to figure out how to be in compliance and make sure they're in compliance. Sometimes there are instances when companies have received letters from regulators indicating a non-compliance. And so we come in and help them become compliant.
My understanding is your group did some review of the 2008 Republican National Convention. Do I remember that correctly?
Which group?
I'm not sure, but in your biography, there makes mention of serving as part of the public safety review for that convention. But that doesn't ring
that
a bell.
Doesn't ring a bell. While I was with the FBI, the convention was in St. Paul.
I think so.
And so, so we had some roles and responsibilities along with that national convention.
Gotcha. So what do you see kind of...
I just read it. Sorry. That was before I joined Waypoint.
Oh, I see. But something
that they might have been involved in.
So what do you see kind of stretching before you professionally in terms of other opportunities and areas that you might want to explore? Or do you feel like you have sort of found a very happy and satisfying professional home for yourself?
Yeah, no, I'm in the right spot, and hopefully in the right spot for the long term. We've got a great group. It's fun to go to work every day, and we do somewhat exciting work, as exciting as forensic accounting and investigative work can be. We're all former investigators for the government and all sorts of different agencies, so we enjoy the work, and I think we put out a pretty great product and provide our clients great value for the services.
Very good. Josiah Lamb is with Waypoint, and before that, a former forensic accountant for the FBI, a proud Carthage alum as well, and a current executive in residence at Carthage College. It sounds like it's been a busy couple of days for you, but we're glad that in this busy schedule you were able to fit in this visit to WGTD's morning show. I appreciate the opportunity to meet you and wish you well with all of the work that you do from here on.
Thank you, sir.
Good to meet you, Josiah Lamb. And Dr. Art Sear, director of the Clausen Center, thank you for facilitating this visit, and we look forward to a visit from you a little later in the month, as you do on a monthly basis on the morning show.
Well, thank you. Thank you both, and thank you for making accounting clear and interesting. It's important, but us non-accountants have a bit of a struggle sometimes. It's
right.
Very, very educational.
Yeah,
thank
it's this important work that goes on behind the scenes that most of us know nothing about, so I think you offered some clarity of that today, so I appreciate that. Thank you again. It's 8:53, time for part two of today's morning show on WGTD. We want to take a few minutes on this edition of WGTD's morning show to acknowledge that this week is Mental Illness Awareness Week. And so organizations across the country concerned with the plight of those contending with mental illness are doing all kinds of special events and fundraisers, including NAMI of Kenosha County. And Jack Rose, who is co-president of the group and who has joined us on the morning show any number of occasions, is with me on the phone to talk about NAMI of Kenosha County and a special fundraiser, which is going to begin a little bit later today. First of all, Jack Rose, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you very much, Greg. It's just really a pleasure to be here, and thanks so much for the opportunity.
Well, this is one of those important issues that, first of all, never goes away, and of course, it's important for us to remind people about the important work that NAMI does. In your view, what is the most important mission of NAMI?
Well, I think the most important mission is to increase mental health awareness throughout our communities and just to provide a better way of life for people that are affected with mental illness. And we do this through our education, our advocacy, and our support. And right now, we continually try to improve the availability of treatment, and I think we're making some strides here in our community to do that. Mm-hmm. Because if you look at the numbers, mental illness touches 1 in 4, 1 in 5 families, and at this time, only 4 out of 10 people with serious and persistent mental illness have access to the requisite treatment. Mm-hmm. So that's what we're trying to do.
Mental illness, of course, has touched on your life in a couple of very personal ways with two different children who have suffered different forms of mental illness. So for you, this is a cause that strikes close to home, so to speak.
Yes, it certainly does. And actually now my wife and I are both retired, and this has really become our passion. And we do this for the community. NAMI has been a real safety net for my wife and I, and so we're trying to pay back for that.
And I should think that in the years that you've been active with NAMI, one of the changes perhaps you've seen is, generally speaking at least, a bit more openness when it comes to talking about this, and especially sharing about this when it affects you or someone you love, versus 20 or 30 years ago when at least for the most part, it seems like mental illness was something that was relegated to the shadows, something that people had a great difficulty talking about openly, which makes it even more of an isolating problem for people.
Oh, definitely, because we continue to fight daily the stigma that's associated with mental illness, and we continue to promote recovery. But yes, I think people now are much more open. In fact, we kind of kicked off our Ending the Silence program this past week at Tremper High School and sent one of our teams. We have teams of two people that go into the high schools, and we try to give the students a better toolkit to deal with mental illness, whether it be their own or their friends. And I think we're seeing in the students today, in the younger folks, that there is a much more openness. And I think with the availability of information on mental illness using the internet, I think people are just becoming more aware. And so we it's all about education, and we need to continue to build on that.
So tell our listeners about the opportunity that they have over the next several days to make a donation to NAMI of Kenosha County.
Certainly. I'll start here with Tenuta's. We will be at Tenuta's from 4 to 7 on Friday. It's coming Friday, tomorrow. And Saturday we'll be there from 9 until 5. One thing with Tenuta's, on Saturday afternoon from 1 o'clock till 2:30, Tiffany Kaneko, 2016 Mrs. Wisconsin, will be one of our volunteers. And Tiffany's platform is mental illness, so we're really happy that she'll be volunteering. She also volunteers in last year's fundraiser. And then on Sunday, we'll be at Tenuta's from 9 a.m. until 1. This year, we'll also be at the 75th Street Pick and Save from 2 until 6 on Friday, and from 9 a.m. until 5 p.m. on Saturday. We will also be collecting out at Richter's Marketplace in Twin Lakes, and we'll be there from 4 until 6 on Friday, and from 9 until 5 p.m. on Saturday. So please come out. We'll have our NAMI aprons on. We'll be there with our cans. And I must say a real big thank you to our community, because over the past they have been extremely, extremely supportive with their donations. And that, as an all-volunteer outfit, that really kind of helps us rolling along.
Jack Rose is co-president of NAMI of Kenosha County. Jack, thank you for joining us, and thank you for all of your good work on behalf of NAMI.
All the best, Greg, and thank you very much for the opportunity.
tomorrow on the morning show, best-selling author Jane Allison, whose latest novel is called Nine Island. Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support